This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted to welcome back to the Radio Cafe James McGrath Morris. He is the best-selling author of several books. His new book is called Eye on the Struggle, Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, glad to be back on.
Who was Ethel Payne, and how did you come across her story?
Well, Ethel Payne was a significant American journalist in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and right up to her death in 1991. But she's unknown to a large part of Americans because she worked for the Chicago Defender. The Chicago Defender was an extraordinary newspaper that catered to black readers. We have forgotten now how deeply segregated the United States was so many years ago. It was segregated to the point that in Chicago, for instance, in the beginnings of the 19th century, when African Americans moved to the North in large numbers, and they were so excluded from the Chicago economy that they created their own world in Southside Chicago, Bronzeville. That was the nickname of the era. Their own banks, their own funeral homes, their own cosmetic companies, and their own newspaper. And the newspaper was particularly needed because white newspapers, which represent mainstream media in the United States, refused to cover anything about African Americans. And by that, I meant high school graduation announcements, wedding announcements, obituaries, the kinds of things that are the basis of a newspaper. So the Chicago Defender was born, and it became the leading newspaper for African Americans in the United States. And it's no more a Chicago newspaper than, say, the New York Times is merely a New York newspaper. So when Ethel Payne came to work for the Chicago Defender in 1951-52, and then went to Washington as its national correspondent, she was the leading reporter for the leading black newspaper in the United States and led a remarkable life.
It's so interesting to read about the Chicago Defender because that was a paper that not only wrote about things like you mentioned graduations and obituaries, but it also really covered all of the issues of discrimination against black Americans.
Oh, yeah.
And it was read not only in Chicago, as you say, but all over the United States. And there was such an interesting detail in your book about how people didn't receive it in the mail because they could be put on a list.
Exactly. In the South, there were communities that banned the Chicago Defender. And they banned it for good reasons. The Chicago Defender reported on how better life was for African Americans in the North. There was enormous segregation, but in comparison to the South, it was, as many people called it, the promised land. Secondly, it reported on lynchings and horrors in the South that often African Americans couldn't find out about. So it was a dangerous newspaper to white supremacists, and they banned its circulation and its reception. So Pullman porters, who are an extraordinary group of men, these were all African Americans who serviced Pullman trains, and we've forgotten now that we hop on planes to get everywhere, but business travelers in the United States depended on Pullman trains. They would get on the train in Chicago at 8 o'clock at night, sleep in a lovely room, and wake up the next morning in New York ready for business. These trains were staffed by African Americans, who was one of the best paying jobs for African Americans in the country. And Pullman porters would take bundles of these newspapers on the train with them to the South and distribute them to barber shops so that on Saturdays, when a black male would come in and get their haircut, they could pick up a copy of the Chicago Defender and none of the whites would be any wiser.
And each copy of the paper was read by many people.
Multiple people, yeah, you passed it on. And what was lovely about this detail is that Ethel Payne's dad was a Pullman porter. He would have been so proud of her. He died when she was very young, and he would have been immensely proud of her working for the Defender.
Now, her parents were part of the great migration mm-hmm. of Southerners to the North, and Chicago's population of African Americans increased vastly over a very short period of time. But Ethel Payne grew up outside of the so-called Black Belt and as a result had certain opportunities that many of her compatriots didn't.
It's a key to understanding Ethel Payne's success. She grew up in West Englewood, Chicago, in a neighborhood that she described as an island surrounded by a sea of whiteness. her small area of several blocks was at first somewhat mixed, and then after the 1919 riot became solidly black, but she was surrounded by white neighborhoods. Why this is important is that segregation in Chicago was not legal. It wasn't a law that required African Americans to live in a particular neighborhood. It was done by realtors, by economic power. But by living where she was able to attend majority white schools and got a much better education than many other African Americans might have gotten in Southside Chicago. But equally important, she became, for lack of a better term, bicultural. She learned how to function in a white society as well as in her own society. And as a child growing up in Southside, that was a distinct advantage for her. And she had remarkable teachers, got to use Chicago libraries, and she started off life much better equipped than another young girl growing up in Southside Chicago would have been.
Not to mention that her mother was a Latin teacher.
I know, I love that. And her mother was, you know, no matter what, education came first. During the Depression, when the kids thought of leaving school to get jobs, she wouldn't let them. She understood the value of education.
Now, there are many details about the whole civil rights struggle of the 20th century, or the multiple pieces of that struggle, many pieces of it that I had not a clue about. For example, the 1919 race riot in Chicago. Mm-hmm. That was huge, and it was a formative experience and really emblematic of race issues in Chicago.
It was. And what happened is that one of the side effects of the mass migration of African Americans to the North, which is wonderfully described in Isabel Wilkerson's book, The Warmth of Other Suns, is that it put enormous pressure on white-black relationships in cities. We forget that the North was segregated, not in the way Birmingham was or not in the way Montgomery was, but deeply segregated. And there was enormous friction between the white and black communities in Detroit and in Chicago, and many times that erupted in riots. The 1919 riot in Chicago wasn't alone in Chicago. The summer was nicknamed the Red Summer. This occurred again in 1943 and, of course, in the 60s. And often it was one incident that sparked it. And it was an incident of segregation that sparked in Chicago. Some black kids basically wandered down to the white beach, and from that it resulted and the death of a child, and then a gruesome riot that lasted for days.
And that resulted in the change in Ethel Payne's neighborhood.
Yeah, that was the final link that the last few white immigrants, and I mean immigrants, these are Europeans who had settled in her neighborhood, moved out, and her block area, if you look at the census data, became universally black.
Now, Ethel Payne wanted to be a writer from an early age. What kind of opportunities were there for black women in the 1930s?
There were simply none. I mean, the statistics are daunting. In Chicago, 8 out of 10 black women who had a job were employed as domestic servants. The idea of a black professional was hard enough, but the idea of a black woman professional is a concept that would have been as rare as a warm day in that windy city in the middle of the winter. And that there was no chance of it. She pursued it, and she had a remarkable bit of good fortune that she really never said much about late in life. She started writing fiction, which was published by a monthly called Abbott's Monthly. And for lack of a better description, think of this as a black New Yorker, a magazine with really high-quality fiction. In fact, Richard Wright had published his first short story in that magazine. She published a series in there, but she couldn't get any money out of that. And so she demonstrated her skill like anybody would have, and today she would have been hired, but there was absolutely no opportunity, and she didn't give up.
So what did she actually do?
Oh, she did all kinds of things. Worked in a nursery school. She worked in a girls' reformatory. She eventually got a good job by becoming trained as a librarian, and she ended up working for the Chicago Public Library. But she hated the job. She was bored silly stamping books and checking out books and all that. And she became active. She joined the NAACP. And perhaps one of the most influencing moments in her life was in 1940 when A. Philip Randolph, the labor leader for the Pullman Porters, organizes what is known as the March on Washington. And most listeners will think when the March on Washington, 1963, failing to understand that the antecedent to that was the original March on Washington, which was to be held in 1940. Why 1940? Well, we were about to enter World War II. I mean, Roosevelt knew clearly we were going to war, even if the United States population didn't know, and we were beginning to build up armament. And our industries were were offering jobs right and left to build tanks and planes, but black Americans were not being offered these jobs. And the military was segregated. So Philip Randolph called for a march on Washington, in which he was going to bring 1 million African Americans to the city to demand that the armament industry be integrated and the military be integrated. Well, this freaked out the Roosevelts. I mean, Eleanor and Franklin knew very well Washington was a segregated city. Where would these folks stay? We're about to go to war. We're going to have civil disruptions on our streets. So Roosevelt gave in and signed an executive order creating the Equal Opportunity Commission. And that was enough to hold off the march, but it created the March on Washington movement, which kept going for several years, and Ethel Payne was deeply involved in organizing the Chicago part of it, and had her first experience dealing with a national civil rights leader, A. Philip Randolph.
And it was interesting because she was a very good organizer and really had a lot of executive ability and a lot of intelligence, and she was the victim of sexism from within her own organizing community.
Yeah, as we know from civil rights history, civil rights leaders were not immune from charge of sexism. But this goes way back. If you remember, the suffragette movement was disassociated from the abolitionist movement, and the two could have fought together. And women were not treated well. But the difference, again, and this is why one falls in love with Ethel Payne, is she doesn't put up with it. I mean, now she's working for the single most famous civil rights leader at the time, and she basically says to him, I'm not going to put up with this. If you want me to work for you, I'm going to have executive responsibility, or I'm not going to be here. And he gave in. And that shows her backbone, which is going to serve her later, because when she rises up and becomes a national reporter, we forget now how difficult her job was. And it took, as she would have said, nerve.
The book paints such a great picture of what it takes to end discrimination, and we never have ended discrimination to this day, either sexism or racism or anything else, but we've taken steps and laws have changed and so on. One of the things that is kind of a cliche that I think that goes around is that the military was ahead of the curve in integrating black Americans, and yet when you look at it, black Americans had to fight for every single victory they got, including in the military. It was terribly discriminatory, even in World War II.
Yes, and one of the interesting things for the readers of the book, I think, is to see the difference between World War II and the Vietnam War. After World War II, you know, 1948, Truman signed an executive order ordering the desegregation of troops. But Douglas MacArthur, the general in Japan, occupied Japan, said, I'm not going to have anything to do with this. So troops remained segregated in Japan. This was really important because we forget about the Korean War, which broke out. And so we sent segregated troops to fight in Korea, which created a whole new set of problems, and it's a story by itself. But Payne, it becomes the first black reporter to cover Vietnam. And what she discovers in Vietnam as opposed to Korea is that the military has not only caught up with time, but gotten ahead of time. And the military becomes really one of the truly integrated institutions in our society that, trust me, there's a lot of racism, a lot of problems, but it becomes almost a meritocracy, and it's not an accident that somebody like Colin Powell succeeds in that world. And African Americans supported the Vietnam War longer than white Americans did because the military offered them opportunities that were not offered to them. But you're right, the military in 1948, when Payne has her experience with it, is a highly segregated society.
Now, she goes to Japan with the Red Cross. Tell us about that phase of her life.
Well, you know, I describe her as a frustrated professional in Chicago, and she has the gumption and the courage to apply and take a job as a service club hostess for the Red Cross, which is taken over by the military, for these service clubs. Now, in World War II, we set up clubs around the world for our troops. I mean, they're in Italy and Germany fighting the war, and then during occupation, they had to stick around. So they wanted to create wholesome places that they could go, hear American music, have American food. Not an uncommon thing. So they had black and white service clubs in Tokyo, and she became a service club hostess in the black one in Tokyo. And it was a remarkable experience for her. First place, it took her out of her own culture. And anyone who's experienced living outside of your own culture, you're changed. You come back and you never see anything the same way. Secondly, it really allowed her to expand her kind of reportorial instincts. In her free time, she wandered around Japanese society. She interviewed leaders. I mean, she knocked on their doors and said, can I talk to you? And she observed a number of things. And those observations is what led to her breakthrough and becoming a reporter.
Well, she kept a diary when she was there, and before she was done in Japan, stories from that diary got into the paper, which led to a very sticky situation.
Very sticky.
And she was saved by, well, you'll tell us.
She had no place to publish her writing, so she was recording in her diary particularly a very interesting phenomena, which was the fraternization of African-American soldiers with Japanese women. There were white soldiers who were doing this as well, but for black soldiers, it was a very different thing to be accepted by a woman of a different race. And they were fathering children, and these were orphans of mixed race, which is a real problem for Japan. Japan is a very xenophobic, very homogeneous, closed society, and these babies were being abandoned, some being put to death and being put in orphanages. So she wrote about these brown babies, as she called them, and she wrote about the fraternization in her diary. When the Korean War broke out, the Chicago Defender and other black newspapers sent reporters to Japan because Japan was the gateway to Korea. You couldn't go to the war zone without going through Central Command. And she met up with Alex Wilson from the Chicago Defender. And she and he, another reporter, interviewed Payne to hear more about this. But Alex Wilson was clever enough to get her diary entries. He sent them back to the Chicago Defender. They rewrote them in a newsy fashion, you know, put a lead on it, but put her byline on it. So there are these huge headlines back in Chicago about the fraternization of African-American soldiers with Japanese women and the babies. This was a big scandal, and the Central Command in Japan was not happy with this kind of writing. So they took her away from the service club, put her in a dead-end job at a desk, and they were going to dismiss her, and that would have been, you know, a very bad end for her. But a little bit of luck occurred. Thurgood Marshall, who was then working for the NAACP, and we now remember as a Supreme Court justice, came to Japan because African-American soldiers were being court-martialed at a rate greater than white soldiers, and for complicated reasons. But he came to defend them. He heard about Ethel Payne's story. He stood up for her in front of MacArthur. MacArthur and the staff let her go, and the Chicago Defender, good to their word, sent her word that it was a job waiting for her back in Chicago.
And so there she was in her late 30s, finally becoming the writer that she'd always wanted to be.
Or even better for us late bloomers, in her early 40s, finally getting a professional job. But what's extraordinary, and there's a bigger plot to this, she becomes a journalist for the Chicago Defender at the very moment that the modern late part of the civil rights movement is taking place. And she doesn't know it yet, but that's going to become her beat. And part of the point in titling the book Eye on the Struggle is that I didn't want to just write a biography of Ethel Payne. I wanted readers to be able to see what she was seeing as an eyewitness to the civil rights movement through her words and her eyes. And what's so extraordinary is that her career matches that movement step by step.
Her beat, as you said, was the civil rights movement. And it's such an interesting moment to be alive, to be a journalist. We think about the 1960s as the time of great change and when Martin Luther King came into prominence and the civil rights era and all of that. It was really brewing for a long time before that.
Yeah, and she was there at the beginning of the movement. She, in a sense, wasn't given the beat. She made civil rights her beat. She was sent to Washington as the Washington correspondent for the Chicago Defender. Its paper did not have a lot of money to have a bureau. She worked out of her apartment, and she became part of the White House press corps. She was the third African-American in a lily-white, virtually all-male press corps, both on Capitol Hill and in the White House. And a number of things happened to her that changed her life, changed reporting, and made her significant. And one of the things that happened was she discovered the power of asking a question. And this goes back to this whole notion of who's at the table really makes a difference. When she joined the White House press corps, she began to ask questions about the civil rights issues at the time that were brewing. And sometimes they were very simple questions. The one I think is just amazing is that in 1954, this is before Brown v. Board decision that desegregated schools, Howard University Choir and two other choirs were invited to a Lincoln Day celebration in Washington. Lincoln Day is the big celebration for Republicans, and they had a lot to celebrate that year. They had a Republican in the White House for the first time since the 1920s. And the Howard University Choir's bus was barred from entering the building. Now, we don't ever know the real reason, but the two white choirs got in and they didn't. Now, this would have been a story that something like the Washington Post should have covered. They pride themselves in covering local news. They didn't know about it. So she went to a national press conference with President Eisenhower, asked him the question. what happened. Now, in his defense, he said, you know, I don't run the celebration, but if that happened, I apologize. It shouldn't have happened, and we'll check into it. As a result, white newspapers, mainstream media, then had to cover that event and point out that the black choir had been excluded. I'm not saying that at that moment she discovered the power, but what she discovered is by asking questions at national press conferences, she could put issues on the national agenda. So later, when she discovers, for instance, in consultation with the NAACP lobbyist Clarence Mitchell, that the president possesses the power to desegregate interstate bus travel. You don't need an act of Congress. He could simply sign an executive order saying, you get on a bus, you go to the South, you can't be moved to the back seats when you get to the South. She asks that question at a press conference. The president becomes very angry over the question. But what it does is that all throughout the United States, newspapers have to cover that issue, and not just cover the issue, point out that the president has that power. So in her first years as a Capitol correspondent in Washington, she's discovering that the mere act of asking a question is an immensely powerful act. She secondly discovers that she can't be excluded from the story. She gets up in the morning. Merely getting a cab across Washington, D.C. is a challenge. It's a deeply segregated city, and a white cab driver isn't going to take her to the White House. She can't go to certain hotels. She can't eat meals in certain places. So she realizes that she's as much part of the story as reporting on the story. So she abandons what reporters often think is one of the most important tenets of journalism, objectivity, and replaces it with a notion of fairness. And if you look at her reporting, she's extremely fair. She writes about really vile segregationists in the Senate, but writes about them fairly. It's clear she's not objective. She has feelings, and it bubbles up through her words. So those are some of the important lessons she gains early on. And then next, what she does that's really significant is that she sees this is not merely a legal and court lawmaking and court-making issue. Civil rights is an issue that involves social protest. And so as soon as the first major moments occur in the South, she begs the paper to send her South. Now, they won't at first. They're panicked about sending an African-American South, doubly an African-American woman. It's an enormous personal risk to go. But finally, she does get to go. And one of the most fascinating stories is when she lands in Montgomery after the beginning of the bus boycott. Bus boycott is beginning to get attention in the national press, but they still the white newspapers haven't sent reporters to Montgomery. They refer to the man we now know as Reverend Martin Luther King as Reverend M.L. King in the paper, and then this other fellow named Abernathy. I mean, they're still feeling their way through the story. Not only is she there, but she's the first to perceive an important historical change, which is that the change in the leadership of the civil rights movement is moving away from the legal area, like Thurgood Marshall, who had won the Brown v. Board decision in 1954, but in 1955 is moving to the clergy and moving to nonviolence. And she's the first person on the scene to perceive that immense change. And you might say, well, why didn't the world know about it? Well, 15% of the world knew about it in the United States, but whites were not reading the Chicago Defender. They were completely unaware of that kind of reporting and depended on the mainstream press.
She really was prescient. She had such good instincts as a journalist.
She had remarkable instincts as a journalist. And it's unappreciated. Again, it's a legacy of racism. When there have been collections put together of reporting on the civil rights era, she's not been included in those. And so you might say, gee, her reporting wasn't so good. I think it's something that's different. I think it's a lack of understanding of who her audience was. When the Chicago Defender was started in 1905, it was strictly published for a group of people who I think about 50% were illiterate. By 1950s, when she was writing for the Chicago Defender, most African Americans couldn't go to college. I mean, they were fighting for the right to go to college, so their literacy rate was very different than the audience, say, for the New York Times or the Washington Post. So she wrote in a very folksy, unassuming style, much more like Ernie Pyle did in World War II. So looking back on it now, editors who look at it think it's unsophisticated, but they fail to understand that Ethel Payne were the eyes and ears for thousands of readers about what was going on. So the headlines often said, Ethel sees hate. It wasn't her headline, it was the editor's headline, because of her personal approach to what she saw and did. But she became the eyes for African Americans and what was happening. So she did two things. She informed her audience of what was going on, and she activated her audience through that reporting.
And she wrote that way on purpose.
Very much so on purpose. I mean, in the same way that, you know, today, depending on who we're talking on, talking to, we'll change our metaphors, we'll change the way we write. And hers was clearly purposeful.
Now, to what extent did the white press or the government or any section of white America read the Chicago Defender, even if to know what the so-called other side was thinking?
Well, that began to change. Parts of the government read it out of fear. I mean, the FBI read it and tracked it much like they would track socialists and anarchists. They worried about the civil rights movement and what it was going to do. But who ended up reading it in the white community were white reporters. And again, let's go back to Montgomery when the white reporters began to show up. They would go to a church meeting and Martin Luther King and Abernathy would get up on the pulpit. They would not say, "Hi, everybody, my name is Martin Luther King." Everybody in the audience knew who they were, except for white reporters who'd flown in. So they'd lean over to the black reporters and say, "Who's that guy? Who's this other fellow?" So there was a spirit of cooperation between the two that grew even more important than that. Black reporters could not talk to the sheriffs. They could not get official information. White reporters could, but they couldn't talk to anyone in the black community because the black community was very nervous about who these white folks are. So every day the reporters met at a drugstore in Montgomery and they exchanged information. So a lot of the reporting that ended up in the white media was material that had been obtained by black reporters and vice versa. And that's the beginning of a kind of relationship. But as a rule, white readers never saw anything that was in the Chicago Defender or the Pittsburgh Courier or the Afro-American or any of the other papers.
And it's really striking how much of what was going on in black America was completely left out of the white papers.
Yeah, it was. And what's also striking is how quickly the black institutions were wiped out when white institutions began to pay attention. I mean, after desegregation, when the Washington Post and other papers said, "Well, we need minority reporters," they turned to the black press and hired away the best talent. And then all of a sudden, if the Washington Post is covering obituaries, covering births, covering all those things, the economic basis for a black newspaper begins to disappear. So in some ways, the victory that the black press achieved begins its death.
Very, very interesting. We're talking to James McGrath Morris about his book, Eye on the Struggle, Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press. Ethel Payne had, as you talked about, gone to Japan with the Red Cross. She then went to Indonesia as a reporter for a conference, again, something I had no idea about, a very interesting piece of history. It was an international conference to which the United States and the Soviet Union were not invited.
And that's very profound at that time in history. The world after World War II was divided, Soviet Union and the West. And the idea that a group of people, and they would describe themselves as a group of people of color, Asians and the new first countries becoming free in Africa and other places, were meeting without the white northerners was a threat to the North and a threat to the U.S. and the United States. But it was a huge story for a black reporter like Ethel Payne, and she got to go, along with a lot of other African-American writers and journalists, and they went to Bandung, Indonesia for this conference, and so did Richard Wright, the famous author. He left Paris. He couldn't believe that this meeting was going on and got funding to go there. And a number of things happened. One of the things that happened that changed Ethel Payne's life, much like her experience in Japan, it broadened her horizon, but it also made her realize how intimately connected the struggle for freedom among African Americans in the United States was with a larger movement for freedom around the world, that they were not separate things. And this plants this idea in her mind that she later fulfills by 13 or 14 trips to Africa. She goes to Africa in 1957 with Richard Nixon, who was then vice president, to witness the first sub-Saharan country become independent with a black leadership. And so her reporting broadens to the point that we see her as a civil rights reporter in Washington and the South, soon becomes a civil rights reporter around the world.
It's interesting also that racism in the United States was well known by other countries and was really a handicap.
It was not just a handicap, it was a tool, a weapon to put in the hands of the communists. I mean, the communist regimes in Russia and then later in China continually make a point that the United States is, in their terms, like apartheid, this awful society, and they use it in the propaganda war. And Richard Nixon, one of the great joys about writing history, and what I get such fun telling people stories about, is if I say to you, Richard Nixon, what do we think of? We think of the Vietnam War, we think of Watergate, we think of all these awful things about him. In the 1950s, he was a very different soul. And he recognized the danger of American racism in international foreign policy, that it hurt the United States' standing. He also recognized that it was a politically advantageous to him to support civil rights because civil rights was being blocked by Democrats, by the men and women who would later become advocates of civil rights. Well, the most of the Democrats who controlled the committees in the House and Senate were Southern Democrats who supported segregation. So the portrayal we see of Richard Nixon in the 1950s in this book and his friendship with Ethel Payne is quite remarkable, because we wouldn't have thought of him doing that.
And, I mean, Republicans really were trying to vie for black votes.
There was a belief in the 1950s that Republicans could win with black votes. Today, you know, no Republican would say that. But blacks who could vote prior to 1932 had voted for Republicans for good reason. It was the Republicans who had freed the slaves. So historically, blacks thought Republicans were the good folks. With 1932, they shifted to Roosevelt. Now, it's only 20 years later, in the 1950s, Republicans are thinking, wait a second, with civil rights, and we are advocates of civil rights, we might be able to regain the black vote. So it's a very different time, and Ethel Payne is there, and her coverage, for instance, of the 1957 Civil Rights Act highlights how people like Johnson and Kennedy, who we think of as these heroes of the civil rights movement, were hardly prepared to support it at that point.
And it wasn't that helpful a bill, because it had been gutted.
But it had been gutted by LBJ and Johnson. Yeah. This is the 19... And what's so significant about this, people might think I'm getting into arcane legislative battles, and I'm not. I'm not even going to bother with the details. What's significant about this is that the difference between the white press, which is the mainstream press, what most people are reading then, and the black press is profound. Because in the battle for the 1957 Civil Rights Act, and in the battle for the 64 Civil Rights Act, which is a major achievement, and the Voting Rights Act in 1965 portrayed in the movie Selma, which is a major achievement, there's a difference in the tone and the reporting that I think is historically important. The New York Times and the Washington Post tend to view these achievements as munificent gifts being given to African Americans. Whereas Ethel Payne and others who are covering it from the perspective of the black press is these are rights that belong to them, for which African Americans had fought to win. So they had a very different perspective on what was happening. And I think it helps explain why so many years later we have this legacy of a racial disparity when we view the media and we view justice in the United States, is that a lot of it comes from a period where the white press and the black press running two different parallel tracks. Now the black press almost doesn't exist, but the white media is still a white media to most black Americans, and the judicial system is still viewed as a white judicial system to many African Americans, despite having a black president, despite having African Americans on the highest courts of the land. And I think a lot of it is a legacy from this period.
And all the while, we really get to see what a fair journalist Ethel Payne was when Republicans did good things. They got credit.
Yeah, she credited Eisenhower for things that a lot of people were upset with her crediting him for, because they were moving in the North towards supporting Democratic members of the party. But the thing about her fairness is that the conditions under which she worked would have, I think, unnerved any reporter. There were United States senators if she approached, would simply not talk to her because she was a black woman. And yet she had to write about them. And early on in her career, she goes to a Democratic convention, and instead of interviewing those people like Humphrey, who are advocates of civil rights, she sits down with segregationists and interviews them, the ones who are willing. So she's willing to go into the belly of the beast, in a sense. And again, when we talked about her asking questions of the president, keep in mind, this is a woman who came out of Southside Chicago, does not have the kind of professional training of her colleagues. She'd been a librarian, after all, just a few years before doing this, standing up in a room full of white male reporters saying, "Mr. President, Mr. President," they turn around and look at her. And she has the tenacity to ask a tough question of a white leader in a society in which many whites simply weren't going to answer a question. That, to me, is a courage.
There's also an interesting anecdote that you describe where she decides to go to talk to one of the really major segregationist legislators, and the kind of, like, double talk or double think that he gives her is just so weird and depressing.
It is, and we forget it. There's a language to what Southern segregationists used to use. They used to talk about, they would often refer to blacks as our, you know, almost like it's a leftover from slavery. Our blacks are comfortable with what we have. They don't want the mixing. And the echo of that that I found surprising is in the North. The language in the North that she covers, when she asks factory leaders why it is you don't integrate this factory, they often said that because the white workers would feel uncomfortable. Oh, I'm not opposed to having an African American, or in their term, they would have said, I'm not opposed to having a Negro in this plant, but our workers wouldn't like it. And it's this constant kind of shoving off onto others the responsibility of keeping the races separate.
Now, Ethel Payne eventually was asked to go back to Chicago. She really didn't want to, and so she essentially lost her position at the Chicago Defender and started working for the AFL-CIO and then for the Democratic National Committee. What did she do with
that? She had a hiatus from 1958 until 1967 of not being a member of the press, and she missed it deeply. But there were two things that were going in her favor. One, the labor movement, which was very racist. The AFL-CIO, in one sense, was giving lip service to supporting legislative change, but they were worried about their membership, and they often had clauses which excluded blacks from working or members of the union. They hired her and put her in a visible position, and she did organize for a while and did a lot of work for them, but she really felt uncomfortable working and left. Democratic National Committee hired her on the same basis, particularly increasing voting, and she worked on increasing voting among African Americans and actually worked on supporting a candidacy in Texas. She was not happy. She needed the money, and it was good money, and she felt, particularly working for the Democratic Party when Kennedy and Johnson were in power, were good things to do, and is a very dramatic moment in her life when Johnson gives the famous "I shall overcome, we shall overcome" speech for the Voting Rights Act, where she was present and then had the power and freedom to fly to Selma and join in the march, which she might not have been able to do as a reporter. Those are great moments, but she, like anybody who reports, once you've done it, it's in your bloodstream. And to her good fortune, in 1967, she gets a call from her former editor saying, "We'd like you back, and if you're not too busy, we'd like to send you to Vietnam."
And so she goes to Vietnam, and as you said before, a lot of African Americans favored the Vietnam War even more than white Americans did. And she went there and really didn't cover the war. She covered race.
Exactly. It's a story that she herself never knew the full dimensions of. If she and I had coffee today, she would be quite surprised to learn the backdrop to the story. And what was happening was that the United States was turning against the war in 1967. Particularly white Americans, the protest movement was gaining strength. African Americans tend to be much more sympathetic to the military because of job advancement. If you were a young black kid in Chicago, you had a better chance of making money and getting ahead, joining the military, than you did sticking around Chicago. And blacks were joining the military in large numbers, so everybody knew something about the military. Well, the White House realized that this was the last group that was supporting the Vietnam War, and using back channels, they were encouraging ways to get the black press involved in covering the war. And the so-called good story from their perspective was the fact that black and white troops were fighting together. Blacks were moving up into leadership positions, and they thought it was a good story to cover, and the paper sent her to cover the fate of black troops in Vietnam. So she went, and she covered it, and again, to use a comparison, she was much like Ernie Pyle. She wrote very hometown stories. Every black soldier she interviewed, she'd include the address in hopes that women back home might write him a letter or send cookies or, you know, that kind of thing. Sounds hokey, but don't forget, these are young kids in an Asian country miles from home. And she wrote, quite frankly, about this situation. She covered the good things. She talked about some of the racist incidents that she saw. But her focus on race in the military caused her to miss the larger story, which is namely the legitimacy of the war, the lying that was going on by the military, and whether or not the war could be won. And late in life, she realized that. She had, by her own admission, says that, in a sense, I kind of blew that story. But it shouldn't be misunderstood. She blew the larger part of the story, but she didn't go wrong in covering the fate of black soldiers in Vietnam.
Meanwhile, Martin Luther King was moving from a sole focus on civil rights to the Vietnam War to poverty, and Ethel was covering that.
She was covering that, and the black community was very torn about this. I mean, a lot of black civil rights leaders were saying to Martin Luther King, don't speak out about the war. It has nothing to do with our cause. And what's interesting is watching Payne report on it, she becomes convinced of the righteousness of what he's doing. And you can see it in her choice of words. She covers a very famous speech, the National Press Club, when he is speaking out about the war. And in part of her copy, you can see her saying, oh, you shouldn't be doing this. But in part of her copy, she's saying, wow, this is making sense. And you can see how torn she is. And she also gets on the bandwagon with him in understanding that at the heart of all this is poverty. That, yes, you have opened up doors by eliminating legal barriers to segregation, to desegregation in the United States, but the real issue is poverty. And what's a very moving moment to me in the book is in 1968, he's been organizing the People's Campaign, where they're going to bring poor Americans of all races and creed, including people from New Mexico, to Washington, to campaign for economic change. And, of course, he's assassinated, but the People's Campaign goes on, and she covers the city that's built in Washington from these protesters. She covers it. She's deeply moved by what she sees. And in a sense, she's one of those who understood what King was doing at that moment.
How did Ethel Payne get into being a broadcast journalist?
In 1972, CBS had a series of commentaries that were aired on CBS Radio and then also on CBS News. These were I don't remember the exact time, 60 seconds, 90 second commentaries, in which famous journalists and famous columnists would come on and say something like, last week it was interesting when the two Israeli leaders met with so-and-so, in my opinion, and they would say something. And the producer, reflecting the change in society, thought it was time to have a woman and a minority on the air. And he interviewed her and did a audio test of her. And so in 1972, she became one of this roster. This was so, again, this is the divide between whites and blacks and not understanding the significance of this. This was amazingly significant. John Ray, who became an anchor in Washington and New York, told me in an interview, he said, the power of turning on the evening news and seeing a black face, a black female face, talking to the national audience made him realize the possibility of that career. And he went on as an African-American to becoming an anchor. So it wasn't just what she said. It was just merely seeing her there that was very profound. It also gave her a whole new audience and expanded her power in a sense.
Now, how did her career fare? I mean, as you said, the successes of the black press and the successes of the civil rights movement were the undoing of these all-black institutions, which had come into their greatest strength during the periods of greatest segregation.
It's a sad tale. In a sense, the movement and the media leaves Payne behind. You know, we talked about her writing style being folksy and intimate and unsophisticated. The white media had hired away the best black reporters from the papers, and she was skipped over. She really didn't have the kind of writing style and the kind of training that they wanted. And the Chicago Defender, she ended a relationship with them and self-syndicated her material. And she became famous as an icon, not as a reporter. People would always introduce her, and that's where she became known as the First Lady of the Press. But she was introduced everywhere for what she had done, not for what she was doing at the time. And then the next generation didn't know who she was. And it's a very sad moment when she goes to a black caucus fundraiser and the guards basically tell her to move because they're clueless as to who she is. And she ends life in some ways quite forgotten. I wouldn't describe her as lonely because she had a wonderful cadre of women. She was so important in being a mentor to women that she was surrounded by this strong group of women who were being successful. But she was no longer as much in the business as she wanted to be. She didn't want to retire, but she was like forced to retire.
And was then forgotten until this book, which is really getting a lot of success already, even on today, its publication date.
It's an odd situation I'm in. I'm a white writer writing about a black woman in the 1950s, and I, of course, had to think a lot about doing this book. And it's a quip, and it's meant to be funny, but it does reflect a more serious point of view. I think we've come to a point where a white bald guy can write about a black woman who became famous writing about a white bald president. She was extremely fair, and I took that as the basis of how I was going to write this book. My book is different than it would be if I was a black woman, but biography is very much like a portrait painting. I think my portrait of her is as legitimate as somebody else's, even though emotionally I'm a different person than I would have been had I been raised a black in a segregated society. But what I find interesting is that we haven't gotten all that far. If you look at the kinds of acclaim the book is getting, it's a lot of things like discovering this person, almost as if I'm an explorer. And it's the reason she's undiscovered is that 85% of America, the white society, never knew about her. She was well known as a postage stamp to her. There are older African Americans who grew up reading Ethel Payne. So for white readers, it's a journey of discovery. For black readers, it's a reaffirmation of the significance of Ethel Payne. And as a writer, this was a really hard line to balance. I have to decide, how much do I tell you about civil rights history? What do you know as a reader, and what do you not know? And striking the balance was the hardest part about doing this book.
Well, I have to say, you do it beautifully. It's so well written. It flows so beautifully. It reads almost like a novel. I mean, I was just page turning.
You're very kind.
No, it's very good, and I'm sure will be an extremely successful book because it's so not only important, not only interesting, but you love Ethel Payne. I love this woman.
I do, and that's a nervous thing as a biographer because being in love with your subject creates new kinds of tensions, and I don't want to give it away, but there are parts of the book where Ethel Payne doesn't do it right. She has clay feet like any of us do, and I have to portray those moments. But it's the first time in my life I've gotten to write about somebody with whom I've been madly in love.
James, what are your hopes for this book?
Well, they're different than any book I've written in that Ethel Payne is a story that a lot of Americans don't know about. So one, I'm hoping that people will become engaged in the dramatic story of a very courageous African-American woman who rose up in a time when there were no opportunities for that, and might inspire others to understand that. But the second is that I wanted to give people a fresh vision of the civil rights movement, and I don't mean to flatter myself by comparing myself to the movie Selma, but what's so significant about the movie Selma is it shows how the civil rights movement was made up of everyday people who rose up to claim their rights. And Ethel Payne was an everyday person, and I don't mean to diminish her, but she did not have the advantages of other people, yet she rose up into a position of leadership that made an enormous difference in society. And I often think that young people today don't understand that we shouldn't be waiting for the next Martin Luther King, the next Reverend Abernathy. Movements are us. And Ethel Payne is a reflection of that. And this book shows her courage, shows her reporting, and gives us a new vision of the civil rights movement as seen by somebody who had a box seat on history.
James McGrath Morris is author of the book, Eye on the Struggle, Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press. And we also want to let people know that because Ethel Payne was a broadcaster, there are some clips of her voice that remain, and so we're going to link to one of them on SantaFeRadioCafe.org, so you can just go to the website and look for today's show, and you can actually hear Ethel Payne's voice. James, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to RadioCafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.